Golf gives you so many endless opportunities to want. And, you know, what I tell my players, you don't ever want to execute out of a deep wanting state, whether it's, you know, wanting something good or wanting to avoid something bad.
This is The Tournament Code.
Ward, appreciate you taking the time to join us today. Know a little bit about your background. We're going to talk about some of your mental work as well as swing work. Before we get to that, obviously, we have to quickly give a shout out and do what we do at the beginning of every episode, which is kind of an icebreaker with our sponsor, PupView Books. They keep the lights on for us. And so what we do is we call the PupView Books opening tee shot. It's an icebreaker in the most normal sense of the word. Jack will give us a trivia question, a golf trivia question, and then we have to come up with the answer, either you or all of us. We usually all put in a guess and then see how it is. So, Jack, with that being said, what do we have today?
Since 2002, Augusta National has lengthened 14 of the 18 holes. What are the four holes that are their original yardage before 2002?
Definitely 12.
That's one.
Nine
has been lengthened.
Has been lengthened. I think all of them have been lengthened. Are we doing par threes?
16.
All the holes count. Yeah, 16.
Oh, okay.
One.
Yeah, 16. I would say is same spot.
Seven. No, it's not seven.
12 is probably the same spot, isn't it?
12 is the same spot, so that leaves one more.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely 14, know the holes it's not.
Six.
We already said six. So far we have 6, 12, and 16. There's one more remaining.
Three.
It is three. That's its original yardage.
Really?
Very nice. Very nice.
It's a diabolical hole.
That's for sure.
I don't want to chip a green side there.
Not at all. Well, Ward, tell us a little bit about your background. Just in terms of everything you do, and we'll kind of dive into some of the facets as we go along.
Yeah, guys. Well, thanks for having me on. You know, I know you had a lot of incredible guests with a lot of incredible insights. So it's great to be with you guys. Yeah, my journey into coaching has definitely not been a linear track. You know, I kind of tell the story that you know, Steve Jobs did a famous commencement speech at Stanford years ago. And one of the points he made is that, the dots in our life sometimes are really hard to connect, especially in real time. But sometimes we have the privilege of looking back and seeing how they connect. And that's definitely been true of me. You know, I grew up as a kid who was initially different from my peers in the fact that I was a person who stuttered. And so, you know, that's definitely one of the first, you know, childhood memories that I have. And, you know, the second probably initial childhood memory I had was being good at golf when I started, especially in relation to my peers. You know, I was a little different in speaking, and I was a little different in terms of being a little better than my peers in terms of golf. You know, I grew up in Paducah, Kentucky, and had the privilege of being able to be exposed to world-class golf super early in the fact that Russ Cochran was, he's a veteran PGA Tour player of 25 years, and he lived around the corner from me. And my uncle kind of got me started, but introduced me to Russ, you know, probably when I was like 10 years old. And Russ was probably, you know, in his late 20s at the time, you know, playing on tour. And he just kind of took me under his wing. You know, every time he was in town, you know, he'd hit balls with me. He'd go out and play with me. And I was just eat up with it. And, you know, early on, I actually got to travel with Russ. My aunt and uncle lived in Memphis, and it's the closest tour event. So every summer I would go. Russ would actually drive me to Memphis, drive me to my aunt and uncle's. And every day I'd go out to the TPC Southwind there and watch him play in the St. Jude Classic. And, you know, I'll just never forget, you know, being exposed to the PGA Tour for the first time and just seeing world-class golf. It was just incredible. But, you know, I progressed pretty nicely to the point where my freshman year in high school, around 16, I won a regional wide tournament that happened to have the defending state champion who went on to play at Ole Miss, and had some other players who played in the SEC. So some really quality golfers. You know, I remember I had 21 putts that week, and you know, something happened to me 2 weeks later in just a regular high school match. I got over a 2-foot putt, and for the first time in my life, I just had an experience of negative thoughts that I had never had before. And I ended up missing the putt, and from there, I basically more or less got the putting yips at 16. And that effectively pretty much ripped away my competitiveness. I was able over the next 3 years to piece it back together enough to walk on my college team at Samford University, played a year there. But from a competitive standpoint, I was pretty much toast, and I moved on to other things. I went and ended up getting a master's degree in religious studies, kind of studying religion from the historical angle. I thought I was going to teach for the longest time, but I kind of got into my academic work there and just realized that I didn't want to spend the rest of my life arguing with a group like yourself about religious minutia. So I kind of had to pivot out of that. I ended up finishing the master's degree. It was a long degree, but once I got out, I kind of had to figure out, okay, now what am I going to do with my life? And it was during that process, you know, I'd always loved the PGA Tour. I had some connections out there. Another Kentucky guy, a guy named Josh Teeter, who I think has been a guest of y'all. He was a buddy of mine. He was playing on the Nationwide Tour at the time. He had a caddy, but I knew if I went out there, I could kind of travel with Josh and his caddy and kind of learn the ropes. So I basically hit the road cold turkey and joined the circus of caddying, trying to work my way onto the PGA Tour. I had two solid years of that. Awesome experiences. Got to meet players like the first tournament I ever caddied in was Keegan Bradley's first professional event in Valdosta, Georgia, and we were paired with him. Funny story there. I picked up a Monday qualifier. Caddied in the Monday qualifier, and I was out there the Sunday before, and I met this guy named Tim Turpin, and I had business cards made up, and I gave them to Tim, and we went out there. We doubled our first hole. You know, Rory doubled his yesterday too. Doubled our first hole, and standing on 18T, we were 10 under par for the day, three ahead of Keegan Bradley in the qualifier. So my caddy career got off to an awesome start in that Monday qualifier. It's a nationwide event. Went on to do that a few years. Met my wife-to-be and decided that, you know, caddying on the Nationwide Tour, you know, not having Phil Mickelson's bag at the time probably wasn't a great career trajectory for me. I'd met my wife-to-be. We wanted to, you know, settle down, have a family, all that good stuff. So I again pivoted back to my hometown of Paducah, Kentucky. But before I finally quit caddying, and I had one event left, and a guy named Brendan Todd he was a young pro, All-American out of Georgia. He had gotten my name as potential to caddy for him in a nationwide event. Brendan had just lost his car from the tour, so he's coming back down to the minor leagues. I connected with Brendan and said, yeah, I've got one event left. Let's do it. So I caddied for Brendan. Brendan at that time was in what he calls his first bout of full swing yips. It was apparent that it was probably going to be a 2-day event for him. But just a phenomenal guy. We went out, shot like 75, 72, hit some great shots, hit about 4 shots off the property. You know, that's enough to have an MC Hammer. And but I had Brendan's number in my phone, and I went on to become a firefighter in Paducah, Kentucky. So 5 years into firefighting, you know, all of us firefighters have second gigs, and I started thinking about, like, what am I going to do, you know, for a second job? You know, I can work on roofs, I can mow yards or whatever, but I've got to kind of figure this out. And during the time, my stuttering had kind of reared its head in firefighting, and it was really interesting because it wasn't the stuff that people might think that I'd get locked up on. It wasn't emergency traffic was typically pretty perfect, fluent, you know, like I am now, but on non-emergency radio traffic, just having to get on the radios in the morning and say, you know, engine one radio check, I would have these massive speech blocks where nothing would come out, you know, for like, you know, maybe 15 seconds. And I experienced these my whole life. You know, I've been hung up on dozens of times by Papa John's, you know, trying to order pizzas. So that's just typical stuttering experience there. But I had never really taken a deep dive into studying stuttering, you know, from the mental angle, the perspective of what the heck's going on in the brain to produce this type of experience, you know. And I took the time, I said, you know, I'm going to do a really deep dive into this. And I did. And the whole time I was learning about stuttering, especially from the brain's perspective, I was thinking about golf and I was thinking about my experience, you know, with the yips and how that, to me, the two had always felt almost identical in terms of the negative anticipation that, you know, when I go to speak, something crazy is probably going to happen. And how that led to disfluency, how that led to avoidance, how that led to substitution. And so the whole time, you know, I'm learning about this. I'm like, look, I can put this into a system to help golfers, you know, deal with performance anxiety in golf. And this is the information that I needed when I was 16 years old. And so I put it in a little system, and you know, I told my wife, now I just got to find someone to share it with, you know. And lo and behold, Brendan Todd had gone on from that time I caddied to him to win on tour. And he had not only won on tour, but he had gotten up in the top 50 of the world. He almost missed out by one on a Ryder Cup pick. And he had entered his second bout of the full swing yips, where he had missed 40 cuts in a row and was literally on the verge of, you know, quitting. And I had his number, and I'd been following his career, and I'm like, you know, I think that this would connect. Like, my story would connect with Brendan's story. He probably doesn't remember me. He's never going to take my call, never going to listen to me or what. But I said, you know, it won't hurt to call, won't hurt to reach out. And I reached out, and Brendan answered the phone, and we set up a call for the next day. And that was in August of 2018. Brendan and I have spoken nearly every day since. And he's gone on to get back in the winner's circle, not once, but twice, almost won three events in a row in 2019, and has been more or less a staple relevant competitor on the PGA Tour ever since. So from that experience, you know, it kind of opened up the floodgates in terms of just doing mental performance coaching with PGA Tour players. Have had the opportunity to work with some NFL kickers, a lot of high school baseball pitchers. Just, you know, so sorting out, you know, how do we bring order to chaotic environments? And so, yeah, that's my story in a nutshell.
No, that's an amazing story. I knew some of the specifics about you being a firefighter and then working through Brendan Todd's full swing yips, but I definitely didn't know the specifics on that. I would like to get into some more of the specifics on your coaching philosophy and developmental programs, and why you don't believe in mental training, and why you refer to the invisible part of the game as the cognitive game of golf.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I kind of joke I'm a mental coach, but I think more times than not, when people think about mental coaching, they think about attitude, which is important. They think about right thinking, which is important. But The mental game to me is about more what I call kind of the cognitive side of things. And that's the information processing thing. You know, every experience we have in life presents itself to us in terms of information, you know, and it's either information in terms of like what we're experiencing is taking us closer to our goals or further away, which impacts our emotions, right? How we feel, you know, our satisfaction levels. And so I'm always looking for ways to smooth out that information processing. And so my coaching has never been what I call head up. It's not like I'm sitting just in an office with a player talking about, you know, how they're feeling or their attitude. What we're doing is we are diving into the scenarios that matter to them, right? The make or break scenarios where if they don't smooth it out, you know, their golf career is likely going to be cut short. And so by that, you know, we take, you know, a look, you know, I was forced to become more or less by experience a student of what I call voluntary movement. And voluntary movement is just what I call any movement that has to be self-initiated. You know, and the thing about us as golfers, every single move in golf is self-initiated. You know, who summons every movement? We do, right? It's different in kind of a cool way from, you know, it's kind of like the baseball pitcher versus the baseball center fielder. The baseball pitcher can control when he starts and stops. The center fielder, basically, once he steps out of that dugout to go on the field, you know, he's reacting to that ball coming towards him. When he's running and has, you know, over 200 feet to throw the ball, you know, it's a totally different mental experience than the pitcher, right? Having to start from scratch. And that's where, you know, we get into kind of the uniqueness of golf is that every move is starting from scratch. And, you know, that has its benefits and that has its down points too, right? And so a lot of our, you know, my mental coaching is, you know, it's what I call a camp out more or less on the preparation aspects, the practice aspects, and, you know, the processing aspects in terms of, you know, on course, you know, how we're dealing with distractions, how we're identifying our challenges, you know, how we're shaping our practice in relation to what we're experiencing on the golf course.
Could you maybe talk more about how you go about coaching a golfer being self-reactive or a pitcher or a kicker and how you implement that teaching into their game?
We got to look at it, you know, from the big picture brain perspective. I think the brain takes into account two basic things when it's deciding how we're going to move. You know, first and foremost, the brain is predictive rather than reactive, meaning before we ever intend to make a voluntary movement, the brain is already scanning the environment to determine what kinds of moves may be appropriate in that environment. You know, the illustration I give is like, you know, when we're driving a car, you know, the brain knows that we might have to get on the brakes. And the reason why we're able to unconsciously get on the brakes is that, you know, information comes through our senses and the brain captures that, you know, in rapid time. And it knows that that's a possible option before we're even, you know, all this is kind of underneath the hood type stuff. But, you know, and it's only we become conscious of getting on the brakes after we do it. And it's kind of like in golf, you know, when we're in a scenario, the brain is drawing on number one source is memories, right? We have a host of procedural memories in golf. We have a host of emotional memories. And the brain is drawing on both of those to determine, you know, Jack has a chip shot. You know, this is what's on the line, right? This is how it went last time and the time before and the time before. And this is some options. Jack can move fluently. Jack can move disfluently or somewhere in between. Right. So, and then the second source the brain's taking into is what I call the kind of the real time inputs. And those are more the things in our process. You know, when we're over the ball, what kinds of information are we basically sending back to the control center? And if you think about it, you know, in golf, you know, I tell people the bad news is that it is time related. So it's kind of like, with me speaking, if I'm in a speech block and have like an hour to get something out, I'm probably going to be able to go at the rate that I want to go at and be smooth, right? But, you know, I tell people, you know, everyone gets in a speech block, everyone gets 2 seconds of normal. If I go to say something and nothing comes out for 2 seconds, you guys aren't going to think twice about it. But once you hit, but usually about that third second on, things start to get weird. And it's kind of like that in golf. You know, if you start, I use 1 to 10 scales a lot. And if you start, you know, at an 8 nervous, an 8 level of distraction, an 8 level of discomfort, it's really difficult to go from an 8 to 0 in the time frame that we have in golf. So that's the bad news, is that the time-related aspect. But the good news is, from the brain's perspective, you don't have to get to 0 to be in a state of positive momentum. You may only need to get from an 8 to a 6. And the brain is like, okay, you know, I got something I can work with here. And so the cool thing about golf is, you know, we can put so much into our process, our pre-shot routine, you know, our process over the ball, that can impact, that we can control, you know, I say some of our thinking, some of our attention, and, you know, some of our voluntary movement. So it's a lot of that, you know, figuring out, you know, what we can put into a person's process to make things smoother, and then as well, like how we can reshape, you know, any bad memories that they may have. And a lot of that comes in how we practice and how we approach things.
So if I come to you and let's say I got the yips of some form or fashion, kind of walk us through where our starting point is in analyzing it, and then what type of preparation I need to do in order to be able to reduce the probability of those yips or issues?
Well, I think for starters, one of the biggest mistakes we make is moving on. And that may sound counterintuitive, because you always hear in golf, you got to move on, you got to move on, you got to move on. And the thing is, there's a right way to move on and there's a wrong way to move on. And we're talking about, like, obviously during a round of golf, you got to do a lot of moving on, right? Because you got another shot to hit. But the one of the cool things about golf is that, you know, one of my buddies on tour, he says, golf always gives you the answers to the next test. Every mistake that we make in one round can be the answer to the next test. And so golf gives us a lot of unwanted memories, right? When things don't go as smoothly as we want. And especially if you're in a bout of the yips, you know, one thing I do is that, you know, I want you to, like, after the round and in your next practice session, I want you to go back and recreate that shot. And I do this with my players who don't have the yips, you know, in terms of, like, maybe, you know, it was an anticipated tee shot during a tournament that made them uncomfortable and it didn't go as well as we wanted it to go to. Well, I don't want them just to move on from that after an event, right? I want them to, you know, at least spend, you know, 15 minutes with that experience, kind of reshaping it, you know, on the range, in deep visualization of everything that they were thinking and feeling over that shot. And I more or less want them to replay it and have a positive experience, because what's going to happen the next time is golf is so scenario based, we are going to be in a similar situation in the future. And again, the brain's drawing on memories. And so the brain is going to draw on that memory from practice, and it's not going to just have to go all the way back to the last time it happened in a tournament. Does that make sense? I think that's a big part of moving on in the right way, is to always be tending to our memory bank in golf. So that would be a huge aspect of what we do, in addition to really taking a look at how you can structure your attention, you know, over the golf ball and you know, things you can do to, you know, more or less trigger smooth swings.
What's the difference between, because I've heard some people posit something similar, in that some people will posit that, you know, yips, the true form of true mental yips are uncommon, and what's more common are technical issues that manifest themselves or that end up with bad results, and then those technical issues persist and it becomes a cycle where you mentally have problems and also technically have problems from recovering. What's your view on yips both mentally and technique and addressing those?
Well, I'm so glad you asked that question. I'm actually working on a book on the yips currently, and one of my chapters is going to be all about that. But for a long time in yips research, it's been likened to what's called focal dystonia, which is a neurological issue. It is a miscommunication between the brain and the muscles. For lots of reasons, I don't believe that's what's going on with the majority of golfers, especially young golfers and young baseball pitchers that deal with these types of dysfluency issues. I think it's a separate issue. I think it's unhelpful to conflate it with focal dystonia. Focal dystonia is, it is real, and there are older golfers who get it, and it is a little less resistant to a lot of mental techniques and practice techniques and stuff like that. But a 21-year-old all-star baseball pitcher who suddenly develops the yips does not have focal dystonia. They have, I think, a very clear phenomenon. One of the things I'm kind of driving at is this, one of the sad aspects is that there really isn't a clinical definition of the yips out there. And I think there's plenty of information for one day for there to be a clear clinical definition, that clearly differentiates it from choking and from other performance phenomenons. So that really, it is important in diagnosing or assessing things. Now, to your question of, can it start with technique issues? Absolutely, it can. Now, I don't believe in every case it does. I don't believe, the day I got putting yips at 16, I think I could have the worst technique in the world and could have got it in the hole from a foot and a half, right? And so, but the brain is always monitoring, right? It's monitoring kind of those inputs that we talked about. And it's monitoring our emotions and our feelings and, how our body's feeling and tension levels and everything. And so one of the things it's taking into account is our clarity, and if we do have technique doubt, if we do have swing doubt, that is factored in, and that can lead towards developing these issues, especially, you're put under choke. I say it's not choking, but it can definitely get started with choking, but it's kind of, you need kind of a duration. Like one study, a baseball pitcher said, you got to have like these issues for at least over a month, but before you can really start kind of thinking, this is that yips phenomenon. Because, it's about your kind of, how we respond to it, right? And so, if it does develop, it is going to get into that deep kind of unconscious anticipation that leads to very conscious negative anticipation. And, I think that's the kicker in the whole thing is the anticipation aspect. We talk about curing it, we talk about defining it, but there's a question in a great form of therapy called solution-based imagery, and it's called the miracle question. And it basically asks you, if you go to sleep tonight and a miracle happened and your problem was taken away, what would be the first sign when you woke up that your problem was gone? And like for me, it's easy. Like for stuttering, it wouldn't be like anything that you all would see, but it'd be a feeling that, hey, when I go to key up that radio, nothing crazy is probably going to happen. And, so it's just that neutral kind of neutral to positive anticipation, that we experience in golf, right? We stand over a shot and we're not really thinking negatively, right? We don't have that negative dread that something crazy is probably going to happen when I go to initiate this golf swing. It's just kind of neutral to positive anticipation. And, in terms of curing it, when that's gone, you're cured. Okay. And that can stay away for years, and it may not ever come back, but it certainly can come back. And, but the key is once you understand it, you're in a lot better position to strategize against it. And that's more or less my message. It doesn't have to be that domino effect that, the 16-year-old gets the yips and he never develops into an elite player. Or that pitcher, never pitches again, or the golfer, is never heard from in a playing sense again.
One of the most famous stories about overcoming the yips in the last few years was Lucas Glover, who had the putting yips pretty bad. And then he overcame that and won on the PGA Tour, I believe, multiple times. I know you've worked with him before. What did you guys do to help him overcome the putting yips?
Lucas is a dear friend of mine. You know, I super proud of the work we did. We got him back into the winning circle. I had 2.5, 3 great years with LG, and we got him back into the winning circle. You know, I always kind of feel like an idiot because I always want to know like everything a player has done to deal with the yips, and it's just something happened in communication along the way. I thought he had used the broom putter, and he hadn't used the broom putter, but you know, we fought it a long time. You know, I say we smoothed it out, you know, conventionally, more or less conventional style, to the point where, you know, he was making the playoffs, he was contending, but he was still battling it, you know. And you know, we were kind of, I was pushing him in the drastic direction of putting left-handed. And you know, I actually, you know, brought a left-handed bullseye to Memphis, you know, the year where we were right on the cutoff line of making the playoffs, and he went on to finish fifth that week. And you know, and we addressed it, you know, a very process oriented way. But he had a couple occasions, you know, that week, and you know, and so anywho, we moved on. And you know, looking back, I kind of, you know, definitely feel validated because Lucas said that he had finally decided that he was going to make a drastic change, and it was either going to be the long putter was going to work or he was going to putt left-handed. And and thankfully for him, you know, the broom putter was such a drastic difference that, you know, we had talked about, like, you got to figure out a way to give yourself that experience of doing something for the first time. And also, you know, I always was telling him, like, you know, my goal is to get you to be able to go to the grocery store without thinking about your putting. And and thankfully, you know, for him, you know, and for other players, it's a weird thing because it doesn't work for every player, but it was enough of a drastic difference in motor skills. It was almost like doing a different task, right? That it was enough to just kind of reset things. And you know, the coolest thing about what Lucas said is that his miracle moment, or the moment he knew that his problem was solved and gone, was in qualifying for the U.S. Open. Here's a U.S. Open champion, and he's out trying to qualify for the U.S. Open, and he's got a 5-footer to basically make it into the U.S. Open, and he missed it, and he was putting with the long putter, right? But he said that was his aha moment because it was just a miss, and everyone misses putts. But everyone doesn't experience the putting yips. And he knew after that regular miss that his problem was solved. And, you know, so that's kind of the story there.
That's interesting how you described that in terms of the anticipation being, knowing, determining whether or not you have that anticipation can let you know whether or not you're cured from it. And it's funny, given that all three of us on this podcast have some form of the yips. Cooper probably the most over it of all of us. Cooper has had the putting yips. I've
had them pretty bad in tournaments. I've used broomstick, arm lock. Right now I'm using arm lock, but broomstick helps. Sorry, Daniel.
Yeah. And Jack has the chipping yips. I have the chipping yips. And for me, actually, I kind of told you my background. Told you I played, got injured, stopped playing, didn't pick it up again for a while. One of the things Cooper makes fun of me for is kind of how I got over. I had what I would call full swing yips. And it happened when I was in college. I got injured, and I had a two-way miss, an extreme two-way miss where I couldn't keep it on the planet. And so, like, after I got injured, it was just all over the place. And I could sometimes, like, scrap something together, but there's never a chance that I was going to really play good golf. I was a king of making 25 footers for bogey. And it was decent at doing that. But the everything else was, you know, off the planet one way or off the planet the other way. So once I stopped playing, you know, didn't mind again. And as I said, that third year of law school, I went out to play in St. Simon's and I was hitting it off the planet again. And that's when I was like, okay, even given 5 or 6 years of not touching a club, this problem still persists. And I still have this scar tissue of just this scar tissue of when I get to the top, especially with driver, it was like, oh man, which way is this thing going to go? Is it going to duck left? Or is my wrist going to feel like it's completely cupped and it's going to go 5 miles right? And this terrible feeling at impact. And so the way that I got a completely new sensation, which as I said, Cooper makes fun of me for, is I switched over to the super big grips, the jumbo grips. I switched over to the jumbo grips and it was a completely different sensation. And so I came back that third year and I was a legitimate 12 handicap. By the time within a year later, I was down to again, 12 handicap missing both ways. By the time I got back, I was down to a 2 handicap who's playing pretty solid. And even at one point, I was a 5 handicap. And in my club member, I was a legitimate 5 handicap, keeping all the scores everyone had watched. In my club member, I shot a natural 2 under, so a net 65. All on my own, and pretty much besides that and 2 other holes for my team, from another guy on my team, I put up all the scores for that. And for me, like, I hadn't thought about it necessarily. Eventually, I switched back to midsize and normal grips and haven't really thought about it much. But what I told Cooper is, honestly, man, it's just kind of fun. Like, I don't have the scar tissue anymore. Like, when I swing, I don't feel anything similar to what I used to feel. And I never put those two kinds of things together, and that you change the stimulus and then the reaction in terms of how you respond to that stimulus can change. What sort of success have you seen? Let's break it down, if you don't mind, or at least try, on full swing putting. We've kind of already covered what sort of stimulus you can put in, you know, changing it up drastically so you feel something different. But on full swing and chipping, what other sort of stimuli have you seen that where you make a drastic change or make some sort of change to how you're doing things? And as I call it, maybe you have another term for it, kind of bypass that scar tissue and heal it.
Yeah, well, change is the key word, right? No one has ever done anything about the yips without changing something. No one's breathe their way out of the yips. No one's relaxed themselves out of the yips. No one has gone back to the fundamentals of solid thinking, focused on their target out of the yips. You know, I think that's one of the worst ones, because, you know, when you have it, you think of the perception of control around hitting a target, you know, when you're in the middle of the full swing yips. That's the one thing that eludes you, right, is their ability to hit a target. So why in the world would your last second thought be about the ball going to the target or getting lost in a visual of something that you desperately want and can't achieve? So putting your focus point, you know, I call it your swing focus over the ball, onto something else is probably going to be the route to go, at least for the time being. But it is change, you know, and ultimately we can change the way that we think about how we're swinging in the golf club, everything from setup to delivery. There's a lot of options there. You know, I'm definitely not a swing instructor, but, you know, I know the options out there, and I know great people who can, you know, help you kind of figure out what those options, you know, need to be for you. You know, same holds true with chipping technique. You know, chipping is, you know, I call chipping probably the most knowledge-oriented part of the game, right? You have to, because we're always adjusting on chips, especially with modern agronomy, you know, how things are mowed so tightly and playing from collection areas. You know, you mentioned St. Simon's, you know, at the RSM last November. I still remember one of Brendan's old teammates at Georgia who he's a mid-am now and has a great job and probably plays more golf than all of us. But But he was talking about having the chipping yips, you know, from these collection areas. And I was watching it, these shots, and it's just like, you know, I heard Colt Mose say, like, everyone at Whisper Rock has the chipping yips. And so, you know, it makes sense because, you know, it requires so much precision and there's so many options and you're having to think through it. So ultimately, when it comes to the change, you know, we can change, you know, how we approach our technique, think about our technique, practice our technique, what technique we land on, what technique feels most comfortable. Under pressure is the key word. And basically, which technique or aspect of the technique do we feel the most control around? You know, it might, for some, it might just be a backswing thought is enough to brush the grass. You know, a great story I had, I was more or less, you know, dealing with some chipping yip issues, and I went and took a lesson from my buddy, who's a phenomenal short game instructor, and he said, Ward, you just get the sense of brushing the grass. And I kind of laughed. I said, look, dude, you know, if I could brush the grass, I wouldn't be here. I can't do it, you know. I said, you're going to have to give me another thought. He said, okay, well, just do this on your backswing. And I felt like, well, I can do that. And what did I do? I brushed the grass. So I got what he wanted. I just didn't get there in the original way he prescribed. And that's so much of golf, right? It's like figuring out kind of that process of how we get, you know, how we get to a good spot. is just that endless kind of figuring things out in golf. So, you know, we can change our technique around those things. We can obviously change a lot of aspects of our process, what we're thinking over the ball, how our attention's structured, you know, where we're going with it. What I tell people is that, you know, if you're over a shot, it's not enough just to know you're having a negative thought and a bad feeling and an unhelpful feeling. You better know where you're going to go and how to get there, and it better not be your first rodeo, right? You know, Rory talked about it, you know, at the Players Championship, you know, and obviously, you know, after yesterday's, you know, historical round at the Masters, you know, he was nervous, right? And you know, those nerves, I'm sure, came with a flood of negative thoughts, and you know, Mr. Don't was probably very loud. And so I'm sure, you know, he fought it and, you know, had those keys that, you know, whether it's just, you know, I'm going to move my attention away from the wanting of the moment onto solid or something like that. You know, it's just golf gives you so many endless opportunities to want. And, you know, what I tell my players, you don't ever want to execute out of a deep wanting state, whether it's, you know, wanting something good or wanting to avoid something bad. So, you know, we can look at our process, and then, you know, and the third aspect is, like I said, we can change the way we practice. You know, we can change the way we practice. We can reshape, do powerful work on our memory bank in practice and how we're just processing things off the golf course, you know. So, you know, when I was 16, you know, the internet wasn't even real, you know, and I didn't have access to, you know, information that, hey, you know, there are professional athletes out there, you know, who had this phenomenon and have gotten through it. Some have gotten through it, some haven't. But, you know, I'm not, you know, it's not, the thing is that, and this relates to all golf struggle, it's not personal, right? It's just, it's human. And I think, you know, one of the biggest mistakes we make in golf is making everything personal, right? It's like you're having a negative thought. Well, something, I must be mentally weak. And that's not what it's about at all. This is just a human phenomenon that, you know, put in under the right conditions, this is how the body can respond. And it's up to us to kind of understand it and again, strategize against it, more or less.
The book you're working on, when do you plan on it coming out?
I'd like for it to be out tomorrow. I've been working on it for years now, but I think we're close. I think we're close. It's going to be called Untangling Golf's Four-Letter Word. So, yeah, I think we're very close on that.
Excellent. When it comes to coaching, I know it's, at least it seemed like from your website, tell us a little bit more about your work. I know you do some mental work and also seems like you do on the course work with players. What is working with a player look like for you?
I spend a lot of time, you know, on the course, especially with my tour players. You know, they all come and see me. I go to about a dozen tour events a year to spend time with me. I definitely want to get eyes on them, what they're doing. We do a lot of videos back and forth. You know, I'll give them a game to do and a process to go through, and I'll have them, you know, get their tripod out, you know, whether high school golfers, college golfers, on tour golfers, and basically, you know, film themselves doing it and, you know, and send it to me. And, you know, what I tell people is that where a swing instructor works primarily off of what they see, I work primarily off of what I hear and the ongoing kind of conversation we have around, you know, what's irritating them and, you know, how we're going to get through it, how we're going to smooth out the rough edges, more or less. So it is very conversational driven, but it's also very strategic driven. You know, with some players, you know, we camp out a lot on course management, target selection, you know, teaching players, just, you know, young players, you know, how to fly to wedge and, you know, why that's important and, you know, how to think about wind and how to think about targets and how to think about, you know, strategy. You know, it just kind of depends on the player where we end up, you know, camping out. You know, for some, it's just how to deal with distractions. For some, it's just how to process, you know, bad results. But everyone is getting work, you know, to process things better, to practice better, and to do things on the golf course that help them be in a more comfortable spot to you know, achieve their best.
Very cool. Well, you'll have to let us know when your book comes out. If people are trying to work with you, where can they find you?
The easiest way is just through my website, it's wardjarvis.com. I'm on Instagram and Twitter, X now, at WJarvis Coaching. And like I said, just feel free to reach out and we can get something going.
Perfect. Well, the last question we ask every guest is the same. For you, it's a two-parter, which I'll lay them both out. First, if you could go back to yourself as a junior golfer and tell yourself just one thing, what would that one thing be? And then likewise, if you could just tell a junior golfer just one thing, what would that one thing be?
For my case, like growing up, you know, I feel like I was exposed to what world class is. So I would have told myself, you know, learn about the yips before you quit. You know, there's nothing more sad to me than hearing those stories that it was only after I quit that I learned about this phenomenon. You know, that's one of the saddest lines that I come across, you know, sadly, lots of times. So learn about it before you quit. Get some help. Have some informed effort around it. And then, you know, what I would tell just junior golfers, and I do tell all junior golfers, is just nothing bad is going to come from getting closer to world class. So it's never too early to learn what world class is. You can go to pgatour.com and their stats section, and they will tell you basically what world class is from 100 yards, 150 yards, 200 yards, and everything you could ever want. And then just start structuring your practice, you know, around that. Obviously, if from 100 yards, tour average is 20 feet, and we're 13 years old, and developing as a golfer, you know, our average might need to be 50 feet or just anywhere on the green. So, but that's a great starting point to calibrate from, you know, at every level, whether you're a high school golfer, college golfer, mid-am, competitive am, tour player, know what world-class is. And because so much in golf is more or less learning or figuring out how to hit less bad shots. It's not necessarily who can hit the greatest shots. It's who can hit more of just what I would call a good enough shot. And a good enough shot is just anything above bad, more or less. So that would be my advice there. You know, to parents, I would just say resist the urge to worry about your kids' sports. You know, I say that as a parent. But, you know, if you think about it, you know, once a kid, especially in their teenage years, once they catch wind that you're worried about them, you know, that's not going to help their confidence. And golf is a game of confidence. And, you know, golf confidence can be built in so many ways, in so many ways outside of golf. Don't necessarily pull your kid out of baseball, you know, just because they're 12 years old and good at golf. keep them in baseball, keep them in basketball, keep them in soccer, you know, if especially if they have any desire at all to do those things, help them, you know, build that confidence, because all in themselves and their ability to figure things out and their belief in themselves, because that's going to benefit them in their golf if that's what they choose to do.
Excellent. Well, people know where to find you on social media and on your website. And likewise for us, if you're listening to us on YouTube, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts, make sure you subscribe, like, and follow. And if you are trying to find us on social media, you can find us on Instagram at The Tournament Code and on Twitter/X at Tournament Code. As always, we appreciate you joining us. Look forward to diving in deeper to what it takes to play elite tournament golf.